Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is October 10th, 2013. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. I'm talking to you from Boulder, Colorado. I'm out for the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. We're going to be streaming live from the conference, and we put the stream up on our blog so you can access it there. We're going to have a great lunch with subscribers on Saturday, October 12th in Boulder. So if you're in the environment, we hope to see you there. I just saw great subscribers at the conference in Tucson last weekend. And I have to tell you, you're about the most wonderful group of people. Very smart, very savvy, very positive. You know, you bump into the tapeworm and you get up and keep on going. And I have to tell you, it's a real privilege to know you and to be of service to you. Also, a subscriber luncheon in San Francisco coming up on October 29th. Our theme tonight is Leave the Complexity Behind. I had Justin put up in our slides this evening a slide that I used from my speech last week. I'm going to use it in the speech this week, and it's called The Financial Coup d'etat Before and After. And I just kind of picked numbers out of the air to help you understand the concept. In the before picture, we see the legacy systems before the financial coup d'etat and after the financial coup d'etat. Before the financial coup d'etat, they had $100 trillion in assets and $100 trillion of liabilities. After the coup d'etat, they have $60 trillion of assets and $100 trillion of liabilities. If you look on the after, you have the breakaway civilization before and after. After the financial coup d'etat, the breakaway civilization now has the $40 trillion in assets. Oftentimes, what I hear as I listen to various commentators and go to conferences is folks saying, oh, we have $100 trillion of liabilities, we have $60 trillion of assets, we're going to have trouble with the debt, we're going to have trouble on the Social Security, on the retirement benefits, everything's terrible, the system's going to collapse. Wait a minute. That $40 trillion went someplace. And the entities that it in now have $40 trillion of assets with no liabilities, and they're reinvesting. And in fact, one of the reasons the coup d'etat occurred was they wanted to reinvest that money in new technology and space and infrastructure and manufacturing base as opposed to pay for people's nursing homes. Now, that's not a pretty picture. I'm not saying I like that picture. What I am saying is that's reality. So before you assume that the economy is simply $60 trillion of assets and $100 trillion of liabilities and everything's going to collapse, you need to look at the picture of there's $40 trillion being reinvested and the breakaway civilization is going gangbusters. It's the legacy systems that are fading away. So I say that because one of the great defenses, there are two great defenses that the legacy systems will use to now reconcile the $60 trillion of assets to the $100 trillion of liabilities. One is called projective identification, and that's where you accuse the victims of what you, in fact, are doing. So get ready for lots of investigations and accusations against fraud, a fraud against all sorts of, you know, small companies and little people, and we're all getting more and more parking tickets and fines and everything else. So, you know, the people who are now showing up to collect their $100 trillion in liabilities are suddenly going to be attacked for doing the very thing that the leadership did, which was steal all the money. But the second thing that I want to talk about tonight is complexity. Rather than say, no, you can't have health care because we don't want to pay for it, you say, oh, well, we're giving you insurance, but you have to pay for it, and it's much more complicated, and you have to do this, and then you have to do that, and you have to pay this money, and then you'll get thrown off, and you have to go around in circles, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And before you know it, you show up, in fact, to exercise your need for healthcare because you have insurance, and oh, well, that's not covered, and this requires more here, and to get that, you have to go to a different hospital over there. And before you know it, in addition to not getting healthcare, you've spent hundreds of hours trying to exercise your promises. And that's simply a way of saying no without having to say, well, no. And the danger is, if they'd said no, you wouldn't have lost hundreds of hours of your time. So this complexity is rolling down. We're seeing it roll down in the healthcare area, but it's happening all across society. And if there's anything I want to do on the Solari Report, it's protect you from that complexity. So remember that complexity is necessary to obfuscate. I'll tell you how I first saw this. I got quite a lesson working at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. We had a program at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, multifamily insurance. And at the time, we were originating $5 billion a year of multifamily insurance. And the question was, if you were issuing federal credit to insure mortgages for apartment buildings, and in fact, you were charging less than market rates, then the question was, how could you equate supply and demand? Because if you're charging less than the market would charge, which we were, significantly less, then let's say if at a market price, you'd have $5 billion of demand for $5 billion of supply. But at a price that's significantly below market, it's government subsidized, you're going to get $25 billion of demand for $5 billion of mortgage insurance. And what would happen is you'd have $25 billion of demand come into HUD, and then it got caught up in what I called the 26-step process. They made it very complex, and the bureaucracy made it very difficult to get approved. And what, of course, happened was you had different attorneys in Washington who were knowledgeable about HUD and knowledgeable about multifamily insurance, and they would be hired by the right people, and they would get inside, and they would walk the applications through. And the applications that would make it through the process were the ones who were politically favored. So think of it this way. You can have an allocation process that allocates on price, or you can have clear political criteria. The politicians can get together and say, we want affordable housing in these places, and so ones that are pink get it, and ones that are blue not, and you can allocate it according to clear criteria. The problem is, with clear criteria, there was no way they could give clear criteria for what they really wanted, which is, we want the major donors to get the $5 billion of credit. So you have a covert agenda, and how do you reconcile that? You put everybody into the 26-step process where they gridlock, and then you allocate the $5 billion by political means that happen in a covert and sort of secret manner. And gridlock, complexity, entanglement is your cover story. It gives you the ability to deny that you're really doing what you're doing. And that's what we're going to see in all these different areas, including healthcare, which is you make the thing unbelievably complicated, and that's how you reconcile the $5 billion of demand. I'm sorry, the $5 billion of supply with $25 billion of demand. Okay. Now, what happens to us if we're not one of the insiders who gets the $5 billion? We have our time wasted going back and forth in the 26-step process. The way I really saw it, I did a design sprint several weeks ago on a weekend I was at Open Source Ecology in Missouri. The blog post is up on the blog where I participated in design sprint to build a micro house. And it was very interesting documenting the steps that Chris Reinhart, the project manager, was using to build the utility wall for the house. And as I documented, I realized, you know, I could do this. I could learn how to build a micro house. And what I realized participating in the design sprint and sort of the process of doing open source hardware is the complexity of home building, the complexity of the mortgage system, and more importantly, the corruption in it, which makes it much more complex and risky to engage in, has reached the point where, frankly, it's just simpler to get together with a group of friends and learn how to do it all yourself. And if you learn how to do it yourself, then you don't need to borrow money to finance it. You know, you bring the cost down so much. So now a lot of people are going to say what I'm thinking in the back of my mind, which is, I don't want to build my own house. That's a lot of work. You know, learning how to build your own house means you can oversee the contractor. So given how much fun it is to do these things, what I would really say is, if you have young people in your family, if you have children, if you have grandchildren, or if you have the time, learning how to do these things for ourselves has become easier than going into a system where complexity is being used as a way of obfuscating corruption and all sorts of things going on. So When you think about freedom from complexity, the more we can learn how to do things for ourselves and get out of that system, the better. Money and markets. The big story, of course, this week is the government shutdown over the budget. As I've said many times, I'm going to keep repeating it. The reconciling the $60 trillion of assets to $100 trillion of liabilities is a process that's going to take years. It's going to go on and on. If you want to understand all the challenges of that reconciliation, please go read my article, Coming Clean, Over the Fiscal Cliff, because I really felt it was so important that we had a detailed, sort of deep understanding and explanation of why this thing is just going to go on for years. So please don't get upset about this one. It's only the beginning. Indications today, the White House has endorsed a short-term debt limit increase with no policy conditions so that they can push out the borrowing authority out to November 22nd. And, you know, I think the chances of there being a default on government debt over these reasons are absolutely zero. There's no reason President of the United States would ever risk a default for such a reason. The Republicans have, you know, one thing it's important to understand is that oftentimes laws are authorized and then money's not appropriated for it. So the House has authorized appropriations for all spending other than Obamacare. The president has simply said he's not going to accept those appropriations without getting one for Obamacare. I suspect that many Americans don't begin to understand how harmful Obamacare is going to be. It's the ultimate in 26-step processes again and again and again. So it's not just our money, it's our time. But and that's why the administration gave businesses a one-year relief. When they did that, they invited major political trouble because they're turning to the what has traditionally been a Republican constituency and said the Republicans can't help you, but we can, and leaving the Republicans looking very weak in front of not only the small business, but the individuals who are not getting a get-out-of-jail-free card. So very surprising political move. I suspect the administration had no choice given the problems they had with implementation. The president announced Janet Yellen as the Fed chief. I suspect that the sort of current mess and the concerns it was causing in the market really put Yellen over the top. I put up a blog post yesterday when Yellen was announced. Let me just read it to you because I think this is a very good outcome given what could have happened. I said, Janet Yellen has been announced as the new Federal Reserve Chairman. That's good news. She was the best candidate on the president's list. First of all, she is an adult. She has also experience within the Fed's bureaucracy, which matters given the constraints under which the chairman must operate. Finally, she is aware that humans exist and that they matter in a healthy economy. While financial fraud could make it possible and convenient for prior Fed chairmen to be indifferent to the right side of the balance sheet, the next appointee will be well served to be concerned with reality. I got a question from subscriber Catherine. Isn't this a figurehead position controlled by the banking cartel at all? Knowing the goals of the bank, are you suggesting that Yellen will just be nice along the way? What is the glimmer of hope you have? I, in one sense, I agree completely with a subscriber who asked that question. The Fed chairman at this point is very much constrained by many different conditions related to what the private bankers are going to do, require, operate. Remember, the Fed's operational capacity in many respects is limited, and the system is very much set up the way it is. At the same time, if you look at the choices and the major competitors to what to Yellen. We had people who I wouldn't describe as adults. I don't think that they are emotionally mature. I don't think they're interested in doing a good job. They have much more of a covert agenda. I think they have much bigger control files. And even though essentially at this point the Federal Reserve is what I would describe as the legacy systems, and even though I would no more do or want that job than the man in the moon, we are always better off for having qualified people who are both ethical and competent. Someone asked me if I didn't feel badly. I had been invited to be a governor of the Federal Reserve and turned it down after I left the Bush administration. Somebody asked me, well, don't you kind of feel sad that it's Yellen and not you? And I said, absolutely not. Everybody has a purpose, and my purpose is in the world that's growing and not the one that's fading away. And if you look at what I believe is ultimately really going on inside the Federal Reserve, I just feel that morally it's not something I want anything to do with. So some of us are entrepreneurs and some of us are, you know, sort of financial staff at the highest levels. And I am deeply appreciative of that somebody of Yellen's quality would be willing to do that job. Lord knows I would not. The financial markets continue to pretty much go sideways. The stock market's been a little bit off. There are many reasons to expect correction in the North American markets, but it'll be interesting to see how they respond when the markets, when the debt decision finally gets made. We've seen precious metals trading off. We have yet to find a bottom on precious metals. And my concern is until we find that bottom, we don't know if we're back in a primary or we're still in a primary trend. I've said the primary trend needs to reassert between now and March. And I believe that's the case. There are others who believe it could take longer. I'm not sure I have the patience beyond March. So let's see what happens. But precious metals is acting weak. And it broke this morning, the 1300 line. So let's see how it does for the rest of the week. I'm going to be with Franklin Sanders next month. We'll be talking about precious metals. But I'll be watching it very carefully and report to you. Interest rates holding their own. The dollar strong despite what's happening, I think. So let's see what happens after the shutdown. Or stronger than one would expect. Two articles I wanted to point out in the blog. One is Airbnb is really leading the way in terms of helping people start to look at places and the value of places because it ties to the rent that they can get. And I think it's a very interesting little piece. It's up on the blog. Airbnb's chief map maker charts the world's neighborhoods. And we're going to, it's all part of the planetary debt for equity stop swap. We're really going to start to see a tight correlation between the sort of how wonderful a place is for humans and life and the value of the real estate in that place. Another quick commentary up this week, Tesla is now number one. The new Tesla S model is now number one in Norway with a market share of 5.1%, which just shows you how wonderful life can be in a country that has a sovereign wealth fund and doesn't drain and pump and dump the population. So don't you wish you lived in Norway? It is a bit cold. Anyway, Ask Catherine. We have an unbelievable... Oh, first let me do a hero. Our hero this week of Fukushima workers who were sprayed by contaminated water as they continue to try and contain what's happening at Fukushima. There was great talk at the Casey conference, very wide divergence of opinion. But I would say that I felt the strongest reports were real concern, of course, that the ocean water continues to cycle to keep the unit that has not been contained sort of under control. With the bigger problem being the stored and new fuel rods up on top. And the question, of course, is if there's another earthquake or tsunami, what in the world could happen? We could be looking at something very dire. Our other hero, we have a co-hero this week, is Derek Zulick, who is the owner of Days Inn in Boulder, Colorado, where I'm now speaking to you from. The Global Breakthrough Energy Conference was scheduled to be at the University of Colorado. At the last minute, they got cold feet, and out we went. And Days Inn has welcomed us with open arms. And I must say, I think it's a far more intellectually and emotionally free place to have the conference. So I couldn't be more delighted, but he's done an extraordinary thing to bring us over, and I want to thank him. It's a perfect example. Entrepreneurs will save the world. Ask Catherine, a lot of questions tonight. If Mr. Global is going to transfer capital from bonds into the stock market, would it not make sense from their point of view to crash the stock market first so they can buy in cheap and diminish everyone else in the process, presumably gaining more control? Absolutely. What do you think 2008 and 2009 was? They already did it. Could they do it again? Yeah, it's possible. But I think if you look at what they did during the 2008 to 2010 period, both real estate and equities, they were able to scarf up an awful lot. You mentioned when you were in the depths of litigation that you studied people who had survived and not what made them successful or unsuccessful. Would you be willing to put up a list of resources? I feel in the coming years it may get ugly and many others may benefit by being aware of this. That is a great idea. That is absolutely a great idea. I have covered pieces of that in past reports, but I think it would be a great idea to sort of pull things together. And maybe if we could help build them, I know a lot of other people have great, sort of great resources. I've done several blog posts on resources or sort of lessons learned from other economies when they collapsed, and they were helpful as well. But I thank you for that suggestion, and we will follow up on it. Why is the story about the woman with a child who runs through barricades in D.C. under the geopolitical section? What's going on there? I put the story up because I think I put it in geopolitical because I think of all the places that it belongs, that's the appropriate one. I don't think we know what the real story, and that is another one of those situations, just like the shooting at the Naval Yard. Where you could spend hundreds of hours trying to figure out, and you'd never manage to do it. But something's very strange, and I can conjecture about 100 different explanations. I don't know what it is, but it's another warning that things are not right in River City. You mentioned that you haven't had a television for many years now, but you enjoy watching movies. With this in mind, how do you watch your movies? I watch my movies a couple ways. One is occasionally I'll watch online through Netflix. I have a little DVD player, the smallest you can get, that I play when I'm in the jacuzzi. And then I have an old television that's not hooked up to cable. It can't receive TV, but I'll use it. And it's rather, relative to the big flat screen TVs, it's relatively small. I find a lot of those technologies can literally be too overwhelming. So I tend to watch it on uglier small screens and then let the art carry itself. Next question. Just a follow-up to the new economy that you foresee in our future. I pray you're correct, as it sounds like the best plausible outcome to an otherwise tenuous situation. Two things that I can't quite square at the moment. The effect of the strategy on decades of dumbing down the population, starting with the schools, and the major deterioration of the U.S. infrastructure, including the technological infrastructure. I think that's all part of the reengineering. There's no point in reinvesting in the infrastructure if you're going to change it. I also think that if you look at what it's going to take to run the new infrastructure or new industrial sort of capacity, they don't need most of the population, and that explains the dumbing down. If you look at what they're up to in schools with the testing, the idea is to call out the kids who can become robotics engineers early on and shoot them on the right pathway. So all of that makes sense to me when you realize that the labor they need is very sophisticated and it's a much smaller group of people. A couple more questions in this venue, which I'll take up later when we get into much more detail about what I think that infrastructure and technology looks like. On a different note, I'm thinking about getting my nephew a 3D printer for Christmas. He's in a physics program, and I thought just having one might encourage him to experiment and become comfortable. I'd appreciate any comments. Make Magazine every year did last year a list of 3D printers to give as Christmas presents and their sort of recommendations. And I would go to Make Magazine and find their latest list. It's the best one I've seen. We got a great mailing from a subscriber in Switzerland that I wanted to read to you. Dear Catherine, being a Swiss citizen, I wanted to explain just a bit. He was writing about the referendum on the Swiss citizens that I put up last week. Today's citizens of Switzerland get $2,800 per month from the state under certain conditions, e.g. if you're over 65 or if you're disabled. And you get money when you lost your job. It's always under certain conditions. A student with poor parents might get money from the state too. The new proposal is you get $2,800 unconditional. It focuses more on unconditional than on $2,800. The actual amount will be defined as part of a political process. The question is conditional or unconditional. Today, if you're disabled and you find a small job that you can do, tough luck, you lose your disability payment. So as a disabled person, you better not try to be of any use to society. And today, financing Social Security in Switzerland is in difficulty, to say it mildly. Thus, a new concept like this basic income would fix a whole lot of other issues all at once. And maybe not an important deal. $2,800 per month is not enough to live in Switzerland. Costs are so high that most people would have to work anyway, except their salary will be reduced by $2,800. There is a socialist component in this proposal. A minimum wage worker today with, say, 3,000 francs salary could consider working at a previous job for only 500 francs difference. He or she would ask for more money. In the end, a low-income person might get 4,000 francs, 1,000 more than previously. Of course, the majority of people will turn this proposal down when it will come to a vote in a few years. But in the meantime, we have lots of discussions in the media about the current system and about the proposed system. This is, in my opinion, the only reason to call for a vote, to have discussions about this issue. It's a great comment. I couldn't agree more. In a way, to put something on the agenda that otherwise wouldn't be a discussion point. That's how things work in the Swiss democracy. That's absolutely right. It's one of the reasons I so love. If you ever really want to see democracy at work, go learn how the Swiss do it. It's quite remarkable. Some politicians suggest that people should work not only till they reach 65, but till 67. And young people, when they graduate, they don't find jobs. And if old people lose their job at the age of 50 or 60, they cannot find a job anymore. It doesn't make sense if old people hang on to their jobs and graduated young people end up unemployed and jobless, get food stamps worth $2,800. Why not pay $2,800 unconditional and no food stamps? At least they can all eat. Then the lucky ones that find a job will earn more and will be able to spend more. And one other funny thing in Swiss is this. A separate proposal to limit monthly executive pay to no more than the company's lowest paid staff earn in a year, the so-called 1 to 12 initiative, faces a popular vote on November 24th. Managers complain that their salary would have to be reduced. Nobody suggests to increase the salary of the low-wage jobs to 1/12 of the high-paid manager salary. Of course not. And while it is on the radar of the media now up to November 24, salaries of top bankers and managers are discussed, sometimes even reduced, and are an issue for Joe the plumber. And in the few years, we have a law for 115 or 120. Unconditional basic income for every Swiss adult is a way to free money from central banks for the poor people. I'm looking forward to your comments on Thursday night. Very astute comments. I agree. We have unconditional free money from central banks for the rich people. It would be nice to balance the equation. Anyway, more questions, which I'll defer to next week. Again, great questions and thank you. I think the comment from our Swiss subscriber shows the kind of debates that are going to be going on as we go through this explosion in technology. This is going to be a conversation that's going on for a long, long time. So get ready. It's all part of the budget explosion and re-engineering conversation as well. Our interview this week is up on the blog. It's a wonderful discussion of 3D printing as an example of the kind of explosion we're seeing in new fabrication technology. I think what's happening in fabrication technology is very important, particularly the speed at which we can translate bits to atoms and back to bits again. That's really what this is about. And the process of taking things from information and into hardware or from software to hardware and back to software is speeding up dramatically. And I think this is only the beginning. So I hope you enjoy that interview. It's going to be one that we're going to be having lots more on innovation and new technology as it unfolds. Our movie in Let's Go to the Movies was to dovetail with the interview. I think 3D printing is a much easier to see when you, or to understand when you see it operate visually. And PBS had a very nice 8-minute short on 3D printing, so we put it up as the Let's Go to the Movies this week. So enjoy it. It's quick and snappy. In closing, next week, John Rapoport has agreed to take his spot next week because we're going to be doing the equity overview with Chuck Gibson on the emerging markets on October 24th. And then for Halloween, I'm finally going to do it. The report on what is the zombie phenomena all about, really. So until next week with John Rapoport, I'll be doing a money in markets. Dovetailing with that. So until next week with John Rapoport, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck. Okay, well, it's my pleasure to welcome to the Solari Report Onat Akinsi, who once a week, one of the things I most look forward to is talking with Onat. He is an engineer and a research consultant and is the creator of Innovation Rex, which I encourage you to check out. It's linked from the blog post for the Solari Report. He advises me on all things technological. He has a wide background. He's an engineer by training. He has a PhD in mechanical engineering from Montreal Polytechnic, and he's published in fields related to machine design and air analysis, but he has wide experience, including with surgical robots and aerospace and power utilities. And he has the integrity of a well-trained engineer, but he is remarkably creative for someone with that background. And one of the reasons I find that to be so invaluable is if you look at what's happening in a wide variety of fields within technology and science, we're talking about different specific innovations that then dovetail with others, and we're getting sort of very innovative results, not just within fields, but across sectors. And so it takes a lot of creativity to look at it and think about it, which is why I'm so grateful he's in my life. So Onat, welcome to the Solari Report. And you're coming in from Montreal, correct? Okay, well, I hope it's a little bit cooler there than it is here in San Francisco. We're talking today about 3D printing. And 3D printing, one of the reasons we wanted to talk about 3D printing is you can't open the papers these days without seeing articles on 3D printing. So why don't we start off by talking about 3D printing, basically, what is it and why is it something that is worth knowing about?
Well, 3D printing is also additive manufacturing. It's the process of first you prepare your design files in some software, and then you input your files into the 3D printer processor. And then depending on the 3D printer type, the print head or either scores out a plastic material or with a laser beam solidifies a layer of powder material. And after this, layer by layer, you put your material, and after the first layer solidifies, the print head returns and forms another layer and so on. So the layers accumulate on top of each other and a 3D object is created. So this is the definition. And why is this important is the first point is the democratization of manufacturing. 3D printing liberates you from the constraints of traditional manufacturing. It gives you new means for entrepreneurship and at the same time for personal expression. This is also very closely connected to the maker movements and rising technological DIY culture. This allows you, 3D printing allows us to put our ideas into reality more easily. The way the switch from inventor to entrepreneur is much, much shorter because 3D printers are getting cheaper and more flexible by the day. So you have more possibilities of seeing your dreams concretely in front of you. And Coupled with this, there are also financial resources offered by crowdfunding. An inventor can offer his or product to the market much more efficiently. So basically, you have your idea. You can easily make a prototype on your 3D printer. And based on that, you can attract investors from crowdfunding side. So this democratization of manufacturing offers many possibilities. The first one is simply that you can print your files, your ideas easily on your desktop, at home, in your 3D printer. The second point is that you can share your files on online CAD model databases, such as GrabCAD, or printing service databases, such as Thingiverse. So you can share your ideas simply instead of just your product. And the third point is that you can send your files to printing services for printing. So you don't have to have the printer yourself at home. You can printing services like Shapeway, where you can send your files for printing. So this was for the democratization of manufacturing aspect. And the second aspect is mass customization. The killer app in 3D printing is personalization. So producing products for a market of one person is really the ideal of 3D printing. So this opens several possibilities. The first one is obviously you can easily manufacture your own personalized ideas into being with 3D desktop printers at home. Neil Gershenfeld, the father of FabLab movement, and one of the pioneers in the maker movement, he talks about a new literacy, a literacy that can provide you more freedom of expression. And he puts this literacy as equivalent to the popularization of reading and writing after Renaissance. So this is a huge possibility. The personal fabrication at home and the mass customization at home. And the second point is that the industries can go through this mass customization way. And companies can offer personalized products to their customers at a more affordable rate. And of course, this will depend on the product, but so the most popular applications today are the dental crowns, or hearing aids in medical industry, they're all done by 3D printing technology. And more prosthetic limbs are coming too. So customized products by industry is also a very promising avenue. And the third point that makes 3D printing important is the industrial side. Not the personal fabrication point, but really the technological capability of the technology, 3D printing or additive manufacturing technology. And this issue is not very much discussed in the media, but there are very distinct advantages offered by 3D printing on the industrial side too. For example, 3D printing helps in the reduction of tooling. As an example, in sandcasting, and sandcasting is the most...
Just tell me what sandcasting is.
Sandcasting is basically you make a sand mold. You put some patterns on in your mold, which is of sand, and then you you remove your pattern, and the mold is solidified, and then you you put molten metal in that mold, and so in this way you obtain your part. But the problem with this is the construction of the mold. It takes a lot of time. You have to make a very intricate pattern inside the mold, and you know, it's a huge process. If especially if your product is complex and big, and it's the real art to do those molds. So 3D printing or additive manufacturing eliminates the use of these costly patterns and really eliminates the time for manufacturing this mold. You can build very complex molds with machines out of sand. With companies like X1 or VoxelJet, they offer the machines in this style for especially sand mold production by additive manufacturing. And the other advantage of the 3D printing in industrial side is the reduction of assembly. Like General Electric Aviation, they started to produce fuel injectors and leading edges for fan blades using additive manufacturing technology. The advantage of this is that in the traditional process, you have to weld around 20 metal parts together, which is considerable work, but with 3D printing, you have in one setting the whole piece at the same time, so it offers many advantages on the labor side, tooling side. And also Boeing and Northrop Grumman, they're also started producing air ducts for the aircraft through additive manufacturing. So it has a lot of advantages. But after this glowy introduction, I would also like to give some warning that we can't hear that much in the media.
Uh-huh.
So as a concept, 3D printing has a lot of future, but the current technology is not up to our own, up to our imagination. The technology is not there. Especially the cheapest 3D printers are not reliable by most accounts, and the quality of the products that they manufacture is really mediocre. It takes time to print even smallest pieces. It can go up to 5-6 hours for a small figurine. And the quality of surface can be really very mediocre. Like you can see the rough lines of the layers on the products. And the second limitation will be a limitation of personal fabrication, not 3D printing, but really personal fabrication. Some industries will always be regulated, like aerospace or automotive. Like you will never be able to do a whole aircraft or a car, because you will be putting public at risk. There will all, especially in terms of primary structure that support and protect the passengers, you will never be able to do that. And the second point is obviously the scale economies. Scale economies will always be there. For non-customized products, mass production will always be the production of choice. But for large volumes of commodity products, at least for the moment, additive manufacturing is not the first choice. However, for small numbers of unique customized products, 3D printing production is the best choice.
Where I see it now as making a huge difference is particularly for business, including small business. If you want to build a prototype and try something, it really does reduce the cost of what I call messing around.
Well, it is passing to a stage right now. It is coming to more part production also. Like there's a movement in that direction, but it's still in the prototyping phase. Of course, there's a subtle optimization point for the number of parts to be produced. Like to judge how much 3D printing is advantageous with respect to other processes. But an indefinite answer on the number of products is really difficult, because it will depend on dimension, complexity, material of the product. So it's difficult to evaluate exactly what the number of parts, ideal number of parts to be produced by 3D printing. But still, as with the dental crowns or hearing aids in the medical industry, it can be advantageous if the parts are very, very customized.
Right.
There is that side.
Right. If you've ever waited a month for a crown, you know how much,
right,
what a big difference it could make. Okay. Well, let's go a little bit into the history, because in fact, 3D printing has been around for quite some time. It's just now that it's starting to reach a point where it excites our imaginations of what's possible. So maybe let's go back and look at the history.
Right. Actually, 3D printing history is older than most of us will think. It started in 1987. The first stereolithography systems from 3D systems were launched, were put into market. In 1990, there were other stereolithography systems offered by EOS, a German company. In 1991, Stratasys launched a different printer model, field deposition modeling. So it has quite a history. These companies were in the market for quite a long time. And equally important will be the work of Neil Gershenfeld, head of MIT's Center for Bits and Atoms.
Mm-hmm.
He and his colleagues were the real pioneers, actually, in the Maker movement. They launched the first initiative in Fab Lab. A Fab Lab basically is a model lab that could be launched cheaply and quickly to provide basic manufacturing capabilities, even for people around the world, like people in Africa. These were actually the first maker spaces and hacker spaces, and they had some basic components, such as laser cutters, PNC routers, and digital electronics design, and so on. And of course, they had 3D printers. And if you read Gershenfeld's articles, you know, really in 1990s, even a long time ago, and his book, Fab, which was published in 2004, he was already talking about most of the elements we're discussing today, most of the elements that are in media today. So he knew all about that 20 years ago. So it's just very recently that all these things came up to the media. And if you go through the stages of 3D printing, right now, we can sum up the evolution of 3D printing in three stages. The first is the control of a shape, like this stage we still are in. Complex shapes, curves, and hollows can be easily built by 3D printing. Complicated inside shapes is the best product type for 3D printing with respect to other machining or subtractive and manufacturing processes. Especially complicated inside shapes is an ideal process for 3D printing. So this is the stage we are in right now. We are going slowly over control over composition. It will be combining different materials, especially. Right now, we are getting to enter this stage. We just can combine different materials with different colors to obtain different shades of colors. But like mixing different materials to obtain different qualities, engineering qualities, is still not in a desirable state. It's too early to say about to talk about this. So this is still a big possibility. You can mix different materials with different engineering qualities. So let's say one stronger and one tougher, and you can optimize the final structure. And the other points will be the electronics, because right now we are assembling all the electronic products. We are putting circuits and some non-conductive surfaces and so on. So we are dependent on 2D printing, you know, in electronics. So we can, with 3D printing, we can always combine different conductive and non-conductive materials, and we can be more creative and create more efficient circuits. So this was for control over composition. And the third stage will be control over behavior. So this will be, you'll be able to create integrated active systems that can sense and react and compute and behave. And so we can create smart materials that can give feedback, learn and think, like robotic structures or machine structures with circuits and sensors. embedded in mechanical structures, and so so without a separate assembly stage, blood vessels integrated in muscles.
I was reading an article last night about it was a professor from Maine who kept talking about printing out robots. So his imagination was pretty far in the future.
Right. I mean, right now there are robots that use these smart materials, but they're not 3D printing.
Right.
But it will go there in the future. You're not there, but so the robot designs are there also. It's possible. And of course, the very last stage, the ideal stage, will be a natural conclusion of this evolution. It will be creation of new life, creating life tissues out of cells. It's already done by Organova. So really creating new life systems with intricate blood and muscle structures. We hope will be possible in the future. So so this was a brief introduction into the past of 3D printing.
One of the things, before we go on, I wanted to mention, I'll put a link up to Gershenfeld's article, a recent article that, and actually we had it up on the blog, but I'll link in this, in those subscriber links for this. And one of the things he says is, that in fact what's happening, and I think 3D printing is an example, but it's in many respects it may not even be the most important example. I just think it's the one that's captured the popular imagination. But what's happening is that we're approaching a time when a lot of these technologies that we've been working on for decades are reaching the point where and part of it I think is the materials are reaching a point where the speed at which and the cost at which we can convert bits to atoms and back into bits is speeding up. So, and that has dramatic economic impacts as well, because imagine, you know, the faster you can go from bits to atoms to bits, the less money you need to spend financing inventory, or the, you know, the easier a lot of the economic issues for, particularly for businesses, change. So I, you know, to me, I think of 3D printing as an example of this, but the profound change that's sort of upon us is this, you know, the speed and the cost of going from bits to atoms to bits. And I think that's a great point that he made. And I'll have that article up on the blog post.
As I said, it can be a big advantage for Amazon, for example, for their warehouses. So, you know, instead of, you know, having huge inventories for many of the products they have, they can just print many of the, like books are done, many books are done today, printing on demand.
Really?
Right?
Yeah.
So there's a parallel definitely in that direction. So maybe now I shall pass to the overview of 3D printing ecosystem.
Yeah, and I just have to brag on your PowerPoint. There's a Anant did a series of briefings with me, and then compiled them into a PowerPoint, which is you can link to in PDF form up on the blog, and it might help to look at that as we're following around, because we walk through the whole ecosystem, and I think it's very valuable. So make sure you check out that PowerPoint. You may want to watch or dive into the ecosystem part as we're talking.
So now I have my presentation open.
Okay.
About the 3D printing ecosystem, I'm in slide 3 that presents the whole ecosystem of 3D printing. So ecosystem concept really helps us to make a parallel between a technological ecosystem and a natural one. So it really emphasizes the interaction between different subdomains forming the ecosystem. Like here, there's 3D printers, 3D scanners, 3D CAD software, etc. And the different technologies, different technological components as species forming these domains. So it helps us to better understand, to holistically understand what's going on in the industry. Instead of just focusing on 3D printers, we have to consider all the other factors in this ecosystem, like scanners or community. So here, as we see, there are 3D printers, 3D scanners, 3D CAD software, reverse engineering software, and community. So 3D printers, will go more into depth on this. Basically, what everyone is talking about, or mostly in the media. But there are also 3D scanners, which are as important, because what you print, in, especially in the industry, you have to inspect, you have to measure. So 3D scanners are very important in that sense. And also, if you're an artist, you want to make your a model by your hands, and then scan it, and then put the scanned file into a software that will produce a meshed file for suitable for 3D printing. So there's also that advantage of 3D scanners, that is the reverse engineering, where you scan your model to be able to print afterwards. There is the 3D CAD software, which is very important, where you can build your own models, and then usually transform this to STL files to be able to 3D print the other file types too. So the capability of your 3D CAD software is also very important.
I wanted to just say, since you and I have been talking, I can't tell you how many people I've run into, both in a business and personal capacity, who keep telling me that both the cost of the CAD software has come down so far and the quality has so improved that there's all sorts of... it's almost like we're hitting a critical mass on CAD software, which has been around for decades. But something's happening where I think so many people and young people can learn how to use it, and it's... I think a lot of it is the economics. It's just economic, and so it's more accessible and more people are using it. And that, to me, is part of the dynamic of what we're experiencing.
Exactly. Like there are free CAD software.
Really?
So, you know, it's getting very popular. You don't have to have any funding, you can just go on the internet.
20 years ago, what would it cost to buy some really good CAD software? Do you know?
Well, it will be in probably tens of thousands, a good software.
And today, what does it cost to buy some good CAD software?
Well, it really depends on what you want to do.
Uh-huh.
A good one, I mean, SolidWorks is like $4,000. It's really for engineers. There are many modules in that. But if you are more on artistic side, as I said, there's the SketchUp, which is not free anymore. It was free until last year. But I think it will cost like $30 per month, something like that. There's also TinkerCAD, which is nearly free. So it really all depends on what you want to do. But SolidWorks, I will say, will be suitable for most engineering applications, and around $4,000.
Which is, for a small business, is accessible, whereas $20,000 or $30,000 might not be.
Right, exactly.
Right.
And it has many, many modules for engineering analysis. It's not only drawing, but there are many other capabilities you can have. Then there is also the reverse engineering software, like GeoMagic, Cubify, Capture, Catch123. So with these, you transform your point clouds into models that you're going to print. So they offer another layer of capability upon the 3D CAD software, you can basically transform whatever you scanned into a model to be printed. And lastly, there are communities like Shapeways, Materialize, Sculptio. So there are many types of communities, and but in general, you can share your files and share your models, and then people can download them into their own computers and print them. Or you can upload your model into the website of the, let's say, Shapeways, and then people cannot download your model, but Shapeways can print it for other people who are interested in having the object in their hands. So these are the communities.
I have to tell you, when I saw your list of the communities in that PowerPoint, I was astonished. I don't know how long has it been that these groups have come up? Is it just recent?
No, many of them are recent, the last 2-3 years, but there are so many of them right now. It's really, I think it's amazing for even people in the industry. It's just amazing how this just exploded in a short amount of time. And they don't have, you know, the same quality, all of them. I must also add, it really depends on what you want to do again.
Right.
So maybe I'll go through some of these subdomains, 3D scanners, for example.
Yeah, please.
So if I go to the 3D scanner slide, so I'm not entering into 3D printer because you go afterwards. So on slide 43, I have this 3D scanner's ecosystem. So I classified this according to industrial high-end scanners to consumer low-end scanners. There could have been other kinds of technological classifications, but this is easier to understand, let's say. On the high-end side, there is LiDAR by Nikon, which is for use in aircraft industry. It's a huge scanner which can measure a whole fuselage. It costs like $500,000. And then we have portable arms, structured light scanners, which are more in the medium range. They can measure like big jigs and fixtures with an acceptable industrial accuracy. They're offered by Faro, Creaform, or Standigler in Germany. Structured light is basically in the hands of Germans. There are lots of German companies. And then there is the consumer side in scanners. There is new scanners like MakerBot Digitizer, much smaller, and the accuracy is much less than with respect to portable arms and structured light. And then at the end, there is the consumer-grade scanners, we can say any smartphone can be used 3D scanner.
That's quite amazing to me that we could someday be in a world where your smartphone can reverse engineer anything and then you can print it out on your 3D printer.
Well, this is amazing for anyone in the industry. You know, it just went so fast. So if I can go to that slide, basically you can take the photos of your object. There is Catch 123 application from Autodesk, which is free. You can download the app in your iPad, or iPhone, any other smartphone, and you take photos. So your photos in 2D, two-dimensional. So the software of Autodesk, they basically stitch your 2D images to form a 3D model. A 3D point cloud. So you can have a 3D model of your let's say cat, and then print it. And it's really, really, really nice. Basically, this technology existed, has been in industry for many, many years. There was industrial photogrammetry, and is still much more accurate. But still, we are seeing that, you know, the consumer side is getting heavier and heavier, and we are going there again. You can easily, the accuracy is not there, but you can easily make some artistic models by just taking the photos of your works, let's say. So it's going there. And the software is free, only that you have to go to the site of Autodesk to be able to do it. I just but again, in industrial photogrammetry, it just always existed. And in CATCH123D side, they also have the Autodesk side. They also have a database where you can download your model and share it with other people. So this is also is becoming a community. And also there are open source options even to this. I mean, you don't even have to use Autodesk's 123D or other capture, Cubify capture also is another alternative. But there is also a free, even a freer alternative to this where you can use open source software to do all these things, so you won't have to use the software of Autodesk. If you are geek enough, you can really play around with algorithms and create your own software. You won't have the limits of Autodesk software, such as the number of photos or relatively low resolution photos. So sky is the limit. In this. So this is for scanners. I'm going to my slide about CAD software, CAD and CAE, slide number 100. So CAD is basically computer-aided drawing, and CAE is computer-aided engineering, and CAM is computer-aided manufacturing. So as you see here, there are many kinds of CAD software in the market. Again, classified according to from industrial to consumer. So we have these high-end models such as CAD, CATIA, NX, or Creo, with which you can do anything you want. It's really CAD, CAE, CAM, all combined. You can draw your parts, you can do engineering analysis, and you can prepare your files on for manufacturing on CNC machining or other sheet metal forming, molding techniques. It's really a complete system, which can cost at the very bottom up to like $30,000, and it can go up to, depending on the number of modules, to $70,000. So it's really, really very high end. There is CAD and CAE software such as SolidWorks and Autodesk. Basically, SolidWorks also belongs to Dassault, as CATIA does, so it's the same company. But it only costs like $4,000 or $5,000 depending on the module. You can again do engineering analysis. It is not as advanced as CATIA or NX, but still it will do most of the job. And then, as you mentioned, we are going more and more consumer low-end products like Tinkercad. I guess it's like $20-$30 a month. Before it was free, but now it's been bought by Autodesk. And then there's free CAD. There are other free CAD software. They're only for drawing, though. There is no engineering analysis. If you're on the artistic side, it will work very fine. And even, you know, for very simple products, it will work fine. If, like If we go to slide number 104, for example, with Autodesk, we can do injection molding simulation. They have a module called Moldflow. We can do design optimization on slide number 5. So you can change the parameters of your model, and you can optimize your model according to the qualities you want to have on your model. And if we go to slide 106, we have Google SketchUp, where you can basically build. It's been Google until not last year. Now it's been bought by Trimble. I don't think they're free right now, but it offers many possibilities. And my neighbors designed their own house with on Google SketchUp. To renovate, it has many, many drawing capabilities. There's Tinkercad, again, more on the mature side, but it offers, again, many basic capabilities you want to have on your drawing side. So now I'm passing to the 3D printing communities. So this is slide number 109. So 3D printing services are again very diverse. Here also there is the industrial, I wouldn't say industrial, but you know, high end and low end side. There are like 3D printing services with no model downloads, such as Shapeways, Sculptil, or layer by layer. They're more, I will classify as high end in the sense that, your models are precious for you. You don't want to share them with other people. You just want to give the possibility of printing them through Shapeways so that other people can order them, but you don't share the models. But there are also other services such as Cubify or CraftWorks where you can share also. The users can also download your models. So you have this opportunity. There's Tingiverse. People again can download their models and print them on their 3D printers at home. So there you give complete freedom for people to use your own files. But unfortunately, the quality also lowers when you do that.
Sorry, what did you say, Ona? I didn't hear it.
You can always share your models with people. But freely, but in general, people doing this, like their models are of not so great quality.
Right.
Like, the freer it is, the model, I mean, the quality gets a little bit downgraded. And then there are other sites like GradCAD, which is becoming really big, and they're based in Boston, and you can upload their models and download other people's models. Their models done in every kind of software, such as SolidWorks, Autodesk, CATIA, you name it. And, you know, the community, it really, there's a huge range of people. They're professional engineers sharing their models. They're amateur students sharing their models. But you can obtain many software models for basically free, and it's a great sharing site. I use some of their some of their files in my work, you know, for testing the capability of software. So it's really very well designed. And there are also like method search engines for 3D printable files, such as Yagi. So you can to make a general search about any kind of file, you can go to Yagi for your own searches. So if you go to slide number 111, you can see that here is Cubify free files, and the quality is really, you know, it's not that desirable. And in Shapeways, slide 112, the quality of the shared models, the models are not shared, so the quality gets really, really high. It's really not jewelry. And in slide number 113, it's layer by layer, they give a printable to guarantee. You can't download again the model, but they'll print them for you. And this guarantee is interesting because not every file can be printed, so they give you and this is a good glimpse of, you know, the present capabilities of 3D printers. So they have an additional printability guarantee. They verify all the downloaded files to see if they're actually printable. So this is also important. So in slide 118, there is Amazon offering 3D printing, additive manufacturing products, be it 3D printers, 3D printing materials. You have all kinds of possibilities. They have an option for 3D printing. And recently also eBay, they have an app for, again, to be able to print relatively simple parts on 3D printing. So this was for the general ecosystem, apart from 3D printers. So I guess we can go to our 3D printers themselves.
Okay.
So if we go to our slide number three, again, I did, slide number six, I made a classification of 3D printers. This I follow the ASTM F42 classification. It's very recent standard.
We have 15 minutes listed for this section, but we're running over. Can we do it in, I don't know, can we do it in half that?
Okay, no problem.
Okay.
This classification comes from ASTM F42 committee. These are representative companies. The list is not exhaustive. So there are different classes of 3D printing. Like in the media, again, we always hear about 3D printing, but there are many different kinds of 3D printing. The most popular one, because the printers are cheapest in this category, is material extrusion, like Stratasys module, MakerBot, Cube, RepRap. They all belong to this category. Then there is material jetting from Stratasys, Connex, 3D Systems Project, so different and more higher quality class of 3D printing. Then there's binder jetting from X1 and Voxel Jet, which has been bought by 3D Systems recently. And then we have wet polymerization, which is basically solar lithography from 3D Systems. And lastly, there's powder bed fusion or laser sintering from EOS in Germany and 3D Systems.
Okay, so let me go over this again. It's material extrusion, material jetting, binder jetting, vat photopolymerization, and powder bed fusion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So okay, I'm ready to go.
If you go to slide number seven, this is material extrusion. It's basically you extrude your material with, through a nozzle and extrusion nozzle, build a platform like layer by layer. Either your platform or your head moves in the Z-plane. And then your platform, again, your platform or printhead can also move in XY-plane. So when a layer is finished, either the build platform moves down, up, or you print out, and another layer starts to be created. So this is the basic, the most common, popular, let's say, 3D printing class. If you go to slide 8, so this is the most popular process. And the first material extrusion process was patented by Stratasys, and they call it fused deposition modeling. And their printers, before they bought MakerBot, they range from $10,000 to $500,000. So there's a big range. Stratasys module, their most cheapest model, as you see here, was $10,000. And then there are other companies. If you go to slide 9, like MakerBot, they've been recently bought by Stratasys. Their replicator costs only $2,200. So the advantage is obviously designed for consumers, not that hobbyists, because they close their open source structure. So it's not very fun to play with for hobbyists, because they went proprietary, and the disadvantage of this and other desktop 3D printers right now is that product quality can be variable, and it will probably depend also on the context of what you want to print. So you can always see those rough lines of layers on your products. Even though their resolution is getting lower and lower by the day, like when they started it was 0.5 millimeters, and now it's getting up to 100 microns. So it's in a good direction. So if you go to slide 10, the advantages of personal desktop printers, obviously they're cheap enough for mass consumption. They're ideal for prototypes and ideal for homes, offices, and classrooms, for making maker movements in general. As well, I will add, as well as much as they're open source. The disadvantages will be, this is also valid for other class of 3D printers too. You have to buy the printing material from the manufacturer, as you will buy cartridges for your inkjet printer. So it's like Gillette's razor blade model. They give the blade free, but razors cost a lot. So it's a little bit.
I know. When I first saw the prices, I said, "Oh!" And I thought my color printer was bad.
Well, it's very similar to that, actually.
Yeah, it's really very expensive.
And so the life cycle cost. I mean, your investment is higher than, and most of the time will be higher than expected, especially if you print a lot. And the other problem is there's the need for material standardization. Everyone has his own materials these days. There are no standards for either materials nor processes. Everyone is doing something. It is still in a very fragmented state. And for material extrusion, the material should be plastic because of heating requirements, and you can't have metals, for example. And lastly, you'll have high in-plane properties, like your layer properties will be high, the layer quality will be high, but the layer by layer quality will be low, because you are adding your layers on top of each other, and that lowers the quality of your whole product. So I'll go quickly to material jetting. It's number 16. I put some links about material extrusion here, so and people interested in this can go to those sites. And so now I'm in slide 16. Material jetting is the process where the 2D printer is like an inkjet head, and it selectively deposits the material, like in really inkjet printers. And the company started this in Israel. They really used very small structures to inkjet printers. So then the layers are cured with UV light.
And that's ultraviolet light?
Yes.
Okay.
And the main advantage of this If you go to slide number 18, resolution is lower than the material extrusion, so the surface quality is better. You can go down to until 16 micrometers, so it's very, very good. Yeah, the products you obtain are much smoother. You can print very fine features, and you can use different kinds of materials, but again, no metals. It's important. I mean, you're all, again, stuck to plastics because of heating requirements. And prices are much higher, but for stress models for 150,000, it's still a disadvantage. And another disadvantage is that there is no high performance or engineering materials. This will be also true for most of the 3D printing systems using material extrusion. We don't have high strength materials that could be used, let's say, in even secondary structures for aerospace. The material strength is not enough for material jetting. So I am going to binary jetting right now. It's slide number 21. So in this method, in this class of 3D printing, a liquid binder is deposited through inkjet nozzles on some powder material in a powder bed. And then you either, again, the same principle, you either lower your platform, or either it goes up. So you obtain, you solidify layer by layer. You basically glue your layers of powder material.
What's the powder material made from?
Well, it really depends on the company. It can be made from plastics or metals. Mm-hmm. Like X1, for example, is they obviously have sands, as I mentioned. It's the real product, real niche now, sand molds. You can use quartz or specialty sands, but you can also use metal powders and plastic.
So you can make something
here
quite strong.
Have more opportunities for different materials.
Right.
And this system was originally developed by MIT, and right now, 3D Systems and X1, they're using the license technology from MIT. So if you go to slide 23, like X1, again, they can, for example, use stainless steel. But there's always a secondary cycle here for furnace for putting the binder out, so it's a little bit more complicated. And X1 models are also used in Shapeways, a community service, a printing service, basically, where they can print your models in metal using X1's machines. Then slide number 24, they have sand systems, X1, these systems are used for sand molds and cores in automotive and oil and gas customers. So it's not only prototypes, and you can basically make products with this technology. But again, I must add, this is at a much higher price. Like X1, the simplest machine, I guess, starts with from $150,000 at least, at the time. It's very expensive. And Ford Motor is using, again, for some prototype parts in their casting prototype parts. So there are other kinds of binder jetting companies. If you go to slide 26, X1's competitor, there's Voxel Jet, which uses it's very similar kind of technology. There are also laser sintering companies. They are basically in Germany, many of these laser sintering companies. It's like there is a German policy to, like a government policy, probably to direct companies on this side, which is also very promising. So it's an industrial side rather than consumer side, and you don't hear these companies as much in the media, of course. And then there is the electron beam sintering companies. using a very similar principle, but instead of laser, they use a thrombin, such as Arcan, to make especially prostate limbs. So I have other examples of voxel jets, and I put some links again about X1 for interested people to go. Then there is stereolithography, wet photopolymerization. So in this, you basically cure a photopolymer with a light, cure a material, let's say, with just a ultraviolet light. It's been commercialized and by 3D systems a long time ago, as I told you. And the quality is much higher than material extrusion processes because we're using light and the resolution is much lower. The surface quality is much better, but they cost more if you go to slide number 30. Some of the industrial applications can cost up to $1 million for big products. If you go to slide number 31, so there's been an interesting development. There's been a company which started from Kickstarter. They launched a desktop STL machine that will be using the same technology from 3D systems. So this will be MakerBot's counterpart, let's say, but with higher resolution, higher quality, and a little bit more pricey, 2030, which is back to 2200. But they've been sued by 3D systems, and they've been using the 3D systems license, so paying royalties to them. This is an interesting development. So the disadvantages of this technology is, again, the materials cost a lot, like $175 to $250 per kilogram. With respect to thermoplastics for injection molding, which cost like $2 to $3 per kilogram. So it's a huge, huge material cost. And they cannot be as strong in the counterpart, with respect to their counterparts in injection molding, these plastics, and some of them can be toxic. So it's how much it will be safe to use this technology in your workshop. You have to have a good ventilation system. And again, there is no metals that you can use with this system for the time being. And the last technology is powder bed fusion, slide number 34. This is a similar technology. You have a powder material and you selectively melt it by a laser electron beam. So you're melting. In this case, you're melting your material and solidifying. So this is also used for the metal and polymer side. And several metals can be used, like steel, aluminum, titanium. And you can obtain more uniform part characteristics with respect to casting, but it can again be dependent on what you're building. Like, let's say if your part is too big, it can even be worse than casting. It all depends on what your part is, what you're trying to do. So if your part is too big, it will take time to cool off, and the part characteristic in the end will not be as uniform.
Is it just the Germans who do this, or do any of the Americans do it?
Americans, I will have to. There are American companies too. I don't remember right now, but of course. It's really more like in German side.
It's the Germans who make it, yeah.
Right. And also they have a history on this. They've been doing this for a long time. And the 3D printing characteristics, and these materials are the metals that we use in this are also expensive with respect to conventional counterparts. So it's still the material part is a bottleneck. And cooling, again, is a problem after powder bed fusion because, you know, if you have to wait for the material to cool, and if your part is big, it will take time. Even if your process is fast, you still have to wait for cooling. So it's another disadvantage. So I guess this was for the 3D printers.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I haven't seen one operate yet, and I've seen a little one operate at Tech Shop, but I haven't seen the big ones operate, and except on the, you know, there are lots of videos on YouTube where you can kind of watch them operate. So I've watched plenty of videos. Okay, well, tell us, let me just turn to the outline. What does this all mean?
Well, about the future, I will say I have my list of negatives for the negatives aspects of the 3D printing for now, for today.
Okay.
So I want to start from the negative part, not to finish with the negative aspect. So currently, as I said before too, materials still are too expensive with respect to, let's say, injection molding. If you use plastic materials, it can cost up to 50 to 100 times. And standards are missing. They start to form ASTM, ISO committees. Still on the material side and or process side.
Could you just explain what the ASTM and ISO are? Not everybody would know.
So ISO is International Standards Organization. It's a big organization where they, and ASTM is like the equivalent in the US, where they organize, they standardize these processes and materials implied are used in these processes so that, you know, we can judge the quality uniformly in every aspect of a process. And they're very important in, if you want to build an aircraft, for example, you want to be certified according to these organizations' qualifications. And most of the time, the standards are prepared by a committee of experts, so you are sure that using these standards, you know, when you use these standards, your parts are really up to the standards of the industry you are in. The other negative point I would say is about intellectual property side. It concerns replication permission. So with this technology, especially in the scanners, as you mentioned, people can take photos of sculptures in a museum and print them. Or if, let's say, you displayed your works somewhere, and people can, again, take photos and make some, transfer them to clouds and print them. And so what about the copyright issues? It can create, many headaches in the future. The second issue about, again, intellectual property is, so even though 3D printing is largely linked to hackerspace or maker movements, we should not forget that many technologies are covered by patents from established companies, such as 3D systems and Stratasys. I gave before the example of Formlabs, which was financed by Kickstarter. They got sued by 3D Systems, and they finally reached a settlement for paying royalties. So we have to be careful with our inventive initiatives because of this patenting issues. And the second and the third issue about intellectual property is that as we have to be careful with intellectual property. We also have to be careful with our open source endeavors and try not to be exploited, because some of the initially open source companies recently turned proprietary, such as MakerBot. They've been bought by Stratasys for $400 million. And so all those funds got transferred to a few people, and not to the open community that, you know, MakerBot sprung from. They basically used in the first stages of their company all open source projects, such as Arduino, RapRap, or other open software. So this is another important point, not to get maybe exploited in the open software, open source side of 3D printing. So now this was the negative part. Now the positive part about the future. So conceptually, 3D printing offers huge possibilities for the future, and there is no, cannot deny this. But we can, we also still have to think about holistically. We have to think 3D printing in a context of ecosystem of manufacturing, 3D printing in context of other conventional processes, machines, and materials such as laser cutters, CNC machines, control systems. There'll be complementary to all the ecosystem manufacturing that still exists. An interesting point will be hybrid technologies, like there will probably be new applications of 3D printing in the assembly side. There is that will probably be 3D printing combined with milling, like classical machining technologies. It's actually already been done by a company called Matsura in Japan. The machine can 3D print. They can laser sinter and mill at the same time in the same machine.
So let me ask a question, Anant, because I live in a part of the country where the auto parts business is enormous, but we also still have a lot of small machine shops. You know, could this technology get us to the point where the local machine shop is making a lot of the parts for the farm equipment and the cars and the appliances? Is that possible?
Well, it will be possible, I will say. But it will, again, I will go on cautious side. It will all depend on the parts they want to make. If
right.
The parts tolerances will be like in, you know, let's say millimeters, they can do it very easily with low cost printers. But if you go like to the, you know, like the cylinders of an engine, so there you have much lower tolerances. You have to be, you know, on the more high end side of 3D printers. So it will all depend on the application, but mm-hmm. Yeah, there is definitely a direction, a movement in that direction, but it will again depend on what your application will be. And the other interesting direction will be the material side, as I mentioned before, like smart intelligent structures done by smart materials, where you can embed materials that you can react with, like use sensors, or use in actuation, use like small cylinders or mechanisms instead of, you know, building them, assembling them from mechanical parts. You'll just be able to print them, hopefully in the future. And another interesting thing will be new applications. So we need definitely new applications, and no one knows how this will go. We don't know exactly what the killer applications will be in this. So I guess if you were to ask the inventors of the computer science in the 30s, 40s about the, you know, the daily use of their theories 70, 80 years later, they wouldn't be able to you know, describe all the software architecture we have today. So it's difficult to predict about the new applications. Probably it will be, I will bet more on flexible electronics side, where you won't need a big for personal fabrication again, where you won't need very big pieces, and you could build some customized electronics at home depending on your desires or needs. Lastly, of course, again, this is the ideal to print life out of printers, out of cells. As we mentioned, there's been organola. They can only build tissues about 20 cells, 20 cells thick, to be used for testing drugs right now. So it's in a very rudimentary stage right now. Hopefully, this will also be an industry in the future. So we'll be able to create organs cell by cell, literally printing organs. So the future of tissue engineering could depend on this, printing sheets of cardiac tissues.
I was out here in California, and I came back, I think, a year or two ago after Organova first started. And I was telling someone about it, and they said, they didn't believe me. They thought I was making it up. And just then they turned on their television set, and there was a TV show about somebody was getting I think it was a kidney transplant, and they had a 3D printer that was printing out a new kidney. So I said, well, Hollywood's getting you ready.
Right, exactly. I mean, we are going in that direction, definitely. And so we can hopefully renew and patch, you know, the tissues on our hearts and on our kidneys. And for an ideal situation, if I can use Neil Gershenfeld words, then we will transition from personal fabrication to the fabrication of a person.
Oh.
So this is the ultimate state.
I'll go along with a kidney. I don't think they can fabricate a person.
Well, you know, just some spare parts.
Right. So tell us, Onat, where can people learn more about 3D printing? If they've listened to this, if they've gone through your PowerPoint, where do they find more information?
Yes. The main problem with 3D printing right now is that there are not so many reference books, especially in academia, because it's very, very new. And as there are no standards, I guess, you know, it's not easy for professors to teach this.
Uh-huh.
Popular books such as Makers from Chris Anderson, there's Fab from Neil Gershenfeld, as I mentioned, and they're very interesting for starting as a, you know, as an introduction to the field. There's the Maker magazines. All over the place. They're, you know, very fun. Their website is very well designed. There is the Wired magazine, which frequently talks about the 3D printing issues. Then there are websites such as Instructables. This is not only on 3D printing, but a lot of, you know, other technologies concerning maker movements. And there are blogs like TechCrunch, Ars Technica, or Engadget, where you can find, you know, you can find information about new developments in the field. And of course, lastly, there is the Kickstarter website itself, which is always good to check to see who is doing what, because, you know, there is advancing so fast, no one can follow what's going on exactly, even in the media. So you can always use the Kickstarter site.
Okay, and tell us how we keep up with you. How do we find you? How do we contact you? Just describe your blog a little bit.
I have my my website, innovationrex.com, and So I am doing research consultancy for different companies right now. So if people are interested, of course, I'm open to be contacted, and you'll probably put my email on your website.
Do you want me to put it up on the subscriber? I'll put it up on the subscriber links.
Okay. As my name is a little bit weird, I don't dare to tell my email address.
Okay, well, you know, Anat, this has been very, this has been incredibly useful process, learning about 3D printing from you. And I think, you know, when you look at the media, I think of all the different kinds of fabrication technology, this is the one that is the easiest for the layperson to understand. And of course, you know, the price point is coming down on the little ones. So, it's captured our imagination, and it's clearly being promoted a lot by the media. But finding out the real deal on it is a whole nother, process. And you've done an incredible job of helping me understand not just what they are, but how they fit into a much broader 3D ecosystem. And I think this has been invaluable. So, I'm hoping to get you back on the Salira report to do, there's a lot more to talk about, and part of one of the ones I'm, as you know, most interested in is the composite materials, because part of what's happening is a revolution in the materials as well. So with that, I can't thank you enough for being on the Salira Report, and I want you to promise us all you'll come back.
Thank you, promise.
Okay, you have a great day.
You too.
Okay.
Bye-bye.